Good morning. Welcome to day two of the 2026 Michigan School Testing Conference. If you were here yesterday, welcome back. If you are new to us today, welcome. We are excited that you are here. What I'd like to do is just take a couple of minutes and at your tables, turn to a colleague and maybe share one thing or a good insight or something that was resonating with you from something that you heard yesterday. That you're just, you know, it's just kind of in the back of your head. Maybe you thought a little bit about yesterday evening and into this morning. And just turn and share just one insight, one key idea, one resonating thought. I'll give you just a couple of minutes. All right, please pause. Please pause. Thank you. Hopefully it was hard to pick just one good thing that's happened yesterday or that's resonating you from our conference. And hopefully today you get several additional thoughts and ideas that might be new to you, that might resonate, that might take back and implement back within your own contexts. I would once again just like to thank everybody who has made this conference such a success this year. We have our exhibitors out in the hall. You guys have all been visiting with them, continue to do that for this morning and into this afternoon. I would like to thank again our planning committee. Their names are listed on page 4 of your program. I would like to thank all of our many, many presenters who spent many hours putting together these presentations and sharing their expertise with us. Thank you guys very much. I would again like to thank Sue Schaffkin from the University of Michigan Conference Services. I would like to thank Danielle Bach from MASA. And I would also like to thank Dr. Elizabeth Moji from the University of Michigan, who helped support the conference by supporting one of our keynote speakers who's with us here today. And speaking of Dr. Moji, I would like to introduce her to come up to the stage. Dr. Moji is the Dean of the Marshall Family School of Education, and she's here to introduce to us Steve Cerisi, who will be our guest speaker for this morning. Dr. Moji.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to see so many people. I told Dr. Cerisi this would be a full crowd, a full room, and you proved me right, so thank you. I like being right. I really want to begin by acknowledging Dr. Frank B. Womer, Professor Emeritus of the University of Michigan and now Marshall Family School of Education. He is the founder of the Michigan School Testing Conference, and it is now in its 66th year. Can you imagine that? He is gone, unfortunately. We've lost him to this, at least this veil, but we still have him in spirit because he lives on in this conference. Dr. Womer served in the Marshall Family School of Education, it wasn't that then, as a professor of educational measurement for 30 years, 1956 to 1986. He also served as staff director of the National Assessment for Educational Progress when it launched the first nationwide effort to assess student achievement in basic subjects. A generous endowment gift from Dr. Womer enables us to recruit eminent and highly influential leaders in education to serve as the keynote speaker of the Michigan School Testing Conference and to deliver the Womer Lecture in the Marshall Family School of Education. So every spring, Marshall faculty leaders confer with MSTC organizers to consider who are the most influential scholars doing really powerful, transformative work in assessment and measurement. And as a result of that consideration and that consultation, we are thrilled to welcome Dr. Steven Cerisi as our keynote speaker here today for 2026. And we're honored to have such a distinguished education assessment expert with us. Now, you could start clapping at this moment, as people tried to do yesterday when I introduced him in the Womer Lecture, but I'm not done. I want to tell you a little bit about Dr. Cerisi. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in psychology from Loyola College in Maryland and his doctoral degree in psychometrics from Fordham University. He then held roles such as Research Supervisor of Testing for the Newark, New Jersey Board of Education, Psychometrician for the Uniform Certified Public Accountants Exam, and Senior Psychometrician at the GED Testing Service. He's currently Distinguished University Professor and Executive Director of the Center for Educational Assessment at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's widely known for his research in evaluating the validity and fairness of educational tests and for his expertise in and innovations in test development. He has many areas of research. Just a few are methods for evaluating content validity, investigating test bias and measurement invariance, cross-lingual assessment, assessing individuals with disabilities and linguistic minorities, standard setting, and technology-based personalized assessment. He's an elected member of the National Academy of Education, a fellow of the American Educational Research Association, a fellow of Division 5 of the American Psychological Association, and past co-editor of the International Journal of Testing and the Journal of Applied Testing Technology. He, as I said yesterday, is apparently easily bored because he also has served as president of three separate professional organizations, the Northeastern Educational Research Association, the National Council on Measurement in Education, and the International Test Commission. So as you can see, we truly have an expert here in our midst, and I think he's going to share a lot of really powerful information about testing and about innovations in assessment. And so without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Cerisi for the 2026 MSTC Conference.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was a really nice introduction. I just need 1 second to plug my computer in. Hopefully this will work. All right, sorry about that. Thank you for your patience. So this is my first time to Ann Arbor. And I've just been amazed at University of Michigan. I've been to Michigan before a lot, to Lansing. So I know there's probably a lot of Michigan State people who have a hard time being here. But I've worked a lot with the Michigan State Department of Education. And before I came here, I was talking to one of my colleagues and I was like, I think the Michigan State Department of Education is probably the strongest Department of Education in the United States across the states. I've probably worked with 20 states, and this conference kind of shows that. I don't think there's another state that actually has a conference that's not just about reporting student results and how to administer tests, but actually about the research on testing and how we can improve testing practices. So it's a real pleasure to be here. As Dean Moji mentioned yesterday, I was at the University of Michigan, and I had this slide that I was going to take out because I know not everyone's a University of Michigan. There's Michigan State people here. But there, when I think of Michigan, there are two really notable superstars. One is Frank Womer, who I just learned about. And as Dean Moji said, his legacy is pretty incredible. But I'm going to bring up one more thing about him later in my presentation. But the other person who has been really influential for me is someone I hired, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, who University of Michigan stole from UMass, and that's Jennifer Randall. And I'm going to be borrowing from her research today, too. But you might be wondering, given all the topics I could have chose to talk about to honor Frank Womer, why did I choose criticisms about tests? I've been at UMass so long, I just say I've been there more than 5 years. So in my more than 5 years at UMass and my more than 6 years in the testing industry, I've seen a lot of change, as those of you who've been around more than 5 years can attest, in the way the public has perceived tests, the way that tests affect society, and the way they enter into the public debate. And I've also been able to step outside the psychometric community to view the impact that assessments have on individuals and society. And that might not sound like a big deal, but we can be very insular and talk to ourselves, and everything makes a lot of sense to ourselves, but we're a very small part of society. So my journey to this broader perspective started more than 5 years ago, actually in 2000. So we're talking pre-NCLB. Massachusetts did have a statewide testing program called the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System. Think about it as the Massachusetts MSTEP. And I was at a stoplight in Northampton, Mass., is where I live, coming back from UMass on my way home from work. And I pulled behind this car, and it had a bumper sticker that said, MCAS with a line through it, these tests hurt kids. And I was like, I just felt like they're coming after me. Like, what do they mean these tests hurt kids? Well, I was like so proud to be helping the state with equating the forms across years and standard setting. And, you know, had some students funded through this, and now parents are getting information about how their kids are doing in school. So this was a real shock to me, a real eye-opener. So I started, you know, stopping people at the supermarket who had like these bumper stickers and talking to them. And it just made me realize that there's a lot more than psychometrics at play here. Around the same time, I came across this article that was published online about students drawing themselves taking the MCAS. And I don't think you could still get all the drawings, but they had like a URL with hundreds of drawings. And here's my favorite. It's a student, you might not be able to tell everything in this picture, but the student is asleep, drooling on their test booklet, dreaming of the school burning with a protest sign saying, don't test, and then the other picture is the mother yelling at the student with the test results. It's like, well, I guess not everybody loves tests. There were some positive drawings too. I had fun doing the MCAS, for example. So anyway, but this is what I think that broadens our conversation. Thinking about how tests are perceived. And the topics I want to talk about today is why we should embrace criticisms of testing. Not only pay attention to them, but follow up on them and research them. What are the current criticisms? So spend a little bit of time on that. Could spend days on that, probably. And then, more importantly, how can we address these criticisms to do better, to improve student learning? And with respect to that last point, there are four things I'm going to draw on that are suggestions for improving the way we're doing things. One is drawing on the principles for assessment in the service of learning, leveraging technology for more personalized assessment, drawing on the principles of culturally responsive assessment, and investigating testing consequences. Okay, so starting with embracing the testing criticisms, why should we do that? First of all, assessment should be a collaborative process. If assessment is separated from the rest of education, it becomes very disruptive. And a lot of the state summative assessment can be that way. It's like in the classroom, teachers like, all right, next week we have to do the M step. I know. And then after that, we'll get back to instruction. Right. So if we think about educational assessment not as separate, something that interrupts instruction, but something that's part of it, we'll be able to support student learning. The other thing, I have Socrates, and that is just Socrates, what he preached, that being aware of what we don't know makes us more intelligent, right? So as we become aware of the criticisms, that's going to help us improve our products, right? Continuous improvement. I can't get on a plane, go to a restaurant, get in a hotel without getting a survey about how are things, right? And then, but in testing, we don't really do that very much, right? Do we talk to students? Do we survey teachers and others about their experiences with the assessments? So if we do these things, I think we're actually going to have more valid assessments. If we can address the criticisms, of course, we'll improve and help students support learning. When I was president of NCME, I tried to steer the community in this direction by proposing that we should come up with some values for the educational assessment community. So some of that spirit is part of this. And this article is published in the journal Educational Measurement Issues in Practice. And I'm going to point out that journal a few times today, and I'll explain why in a second. Okay, so what are the criticisms of testing? Yesterday when I gave this talk at the University of Michigan, it was a smaller group, and we actually took a little bit of time. I could say, what are the criticisms? This room is probably too big for that. But think for a minute, what would you say the criticisms of testing are? I actually have a survey that you can fill out on that, but my wife told me if I put the URL up now, people just take the survey and not listen to the talk, so that will come at the end. But anyone want to scream out what their major criticism is or criticisms you've heard about testing? I'm sorry? Slow feedback loop. You test in May, you get the results back in October, right? So that not a lot of as much value there. Too many tests. Who said that? Too many, meaning taking time away from instruction. Okay, other criticisms? Anxiety. Who's that? Anxiety for whom?
Everybody.
Everybody. Everybody. Okay. Who's that? Kids don't care, so it's pointless. What's the point? What's the point? No value. Yeah. Teaching to the test, so its effect on curriculum is narrowing what we teach. So again, that theme of value, the amount of time testing, is it worth it? What's the value added? What's the benefit from all this time we spend testing? Maybe we should stop. Everyone's just going to leave depressed. Yes? Sheer amount of tests, so test fatigue. How well are we measuring it if people are just burnt out? We're going to lock the doors so nobody has to leave depressed. Maybe one more? I'm sorry? Tests are biased. Bias filtered in the test. Bias filtered in the test. Okay, that's a pretty good list. So we could go on. I have come together with 9 major criticisms. Let's see how many came up in our quick discussion there. Contributing to and perpetuating systemic oppression. So that and number 8 are similar to the bias, although that didn't come up specifically. Harmful to mental health. Do not measure important skills. Hurt instruction. No useful feedback. That came up. Time limits are too short. Not transparent. People get a score. They don't understand what it means. Inherent cultural and socioeconomic status biases, used for purposes beyond what they're made for. So I'm going to go through some of these, and then we'll talk about how to address them. All right, the first one, tests contributing to and perpetuating systemic oppression. This is really something I didn't see until probably, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement around 2018, 2019. And I think probably the best example of this is in 2018 in New York City, the mayor, Bill de Blasio, wanted to stop using the high school admissions test that they use in New York. So New York has these 5 super competitive high schools. And the example he has here, Stuyvesant High School in its last admissions process only admitted 10 African-American students out of a class of 1,000. And he says the problem is, in fact, the test on many levels. The test is the only admissions requirement, the only admissions criterion. They just use select people based on the test scores. And those of you who've taken a course in statistics can see de Blasio's using the universal symbol for a standard deviation unit. That's how big the problem is, right? But seriously, what validity study is going to justify that amount of adverse impact? Around the same time, well, in 2020, in Chile, in 3 different cities, students' organizations broke in to where they housed the test booklets, stole them, and burned them in the streets. That's how upset they were with the college admissions testing program in Chile. And the same year, the College Board lost their biggest customer. The University of California system stopped using the SAT and ACT. And this is something that a lot of people saw coming for a while, because the adverse impact on the SAT, the adverse impact on Hispanic and Latino students in particular getting into universities in California was huge. And so for 20 years, they were telling the College Board that this was a problem. And true to form of the psychometric community, which admittedly I'm a part of, look at these differential predictive validity studies. There's no differential predictive validity. In fact, the scores tend to overpredict Hispanic and Latinos a little bit. So the problem's not the test. That argument lasted for about 20 years, and finally they said, we just can't do it anymore. We just can't do it anymore. So this idea that tests are part of systemic oppression is that because we're using tests as the criterion for people to get into college, to get into these competitive high schools, and they're not getting in because, according to different racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups, it is contributing to keeping these groups down. This article, also in Educational Measurement Issues in Practice, talked about does the testing industry need to start to have some corporate social responsibility? And the first author here, Mladen, who's from Chile, used the example of Nike. In the 1980s, Nike was criticized and they lost a lot of business because they were using child labor in Asia to build their sneakers. And over time, the way Nike resolved that is they assumed some social responsibility, stopped using those practices, and they got back on track. So this idea of corporate social responsibility for the testing industry generated this focal article in EMIP, and there were 18 responses to it. So for those of you interested in the college admissions testing controversy, I'll recommend that to you. The second criticism did come up, harmful to mental health. And typically we think of students' mental health, students being stressed and so forth. But recently I've had some teachers, remind me that it's pretty stressful for them too, principals. And I didn't think of it until this morning, but maybe district, state testing directors, people working in the Department of Education and so forth can be very stressful. And this comic here has, a student taking the test and then all the policymakers looking over their shoulder. It just reminds us, what do we value the most? What should we be thinking about? Should we be thinking about our accountability metrics? Should we be thinking about the student? And one of the worst examples of that, I did a sabbatical in Spain with my family in 2009, and we came back in May. So we had been away from January to May, and my son, who's in seventh grade, goes back to school, and before they let him go into the classroom, he had to take the MCAS. And he's somebody, he hadn't been in class. All he wants to do is be with his friends. I'm like, do they care about my son, or do they care about their participation requirement? Not measuring important skills. So we do a lot of work in assessing adults. So the assessments tend to be disconnected from the workplace. Measuring only test-taking skills, I think that came up earlier. Don't measure higher order thinking skills, more important skills, misaligned with instruction, and hurting instruction, right? Teaching toward the test. And one of the big complaints is that a lot of students in a lot of contexts, whether they're adults or children, don't get to see the items after they take the test and for test security reasons or whatever. And when we're engaging with adults, they want to see the items they took. They want to understand if they got what they got right, what they got wrong, and understand why they got things wrong. So that type of feedback they don't get, which contributes to this idea of having no value and test functioning mainly as gatekeeping tools for sorting and selection rather than supporting learning. Huge criticism. People take different amounts of time to complete tests, so time limits are an issue. And the idea of not being transparent. So when we engage with some of the people taking tests, like, I don't know what the score means. I don't know how they got this score and so forth. With respect to inherent cultural and socioeconomic status biases, a couple of readings in this area that I want to draw from. And Stewart and Haynes mentioned, by framing outcomes as objective and race-neutral, standardized tests reinforce meritocratic and colorblind ideologies that legitimize inequality. And I think what they mean by this is we often think of these test scores as very objective because it's a number, right? We know what numbers mean, but if we think about where the numbers come from and how the tests were created, there's more to that story than just a number. There's a special issue of the journal, I'm forgetting the name, but if you write to me, I'll send you the reference, where it's on the GRE. And Malik Boykin points out that this myth of meritocracy that the GRE represents, this cultural neutral metric for business schools, is highly problematic. And for a white guy reading this quote here, the illusion that a race-neutral or cultural-neutral test could even exist is a privilege that only white people experience. It's like, wow, that's a pretty powerful statement. And this fact that standardized testing is part of the cultural force field that helps to cause and maintain inequality in society. And if you look at this literature, and this is actually a really good article to read if you want to read the other side of pushing back against the idea of a culturally free metric, is there's a lot of research if you develop the test from a different cultural perspective. For example, one of my favorite articles in this area is called Rugby versus Soccer. It comes out of South Africa, where they had an intelligence test developed from the Afrikaans cultural perspective or from the white cultural perspective, and the rank ordering of groups who performed on the test totally was determined by which cultural perspective the test was written to. The last criticism I'm going to talk about today is tests being used for purposes beyond what they're made for. So tests can be really good at, like, for example, capturing a snapshot of student learning at a particular point in time, but things like using tests to evaluate teachers and other things that kind of are extrapolations of their original purposes are highly problematic. One just example of that, this one graph has to do with student growth percentiles. There's just so much research on their unreliability, yet 22 states are using student growth percentiles. You might not be able to see this graph very well, but that vertical axis goes up to 0.8, and that's a misclassification rate. So this is up to about 70% of students are misclassified, whether they're lower growth or higher growth, for example. And this study shows that if a student has a growth percentile of 50, if you put an error band on that, try and guess what that error band would be. It goes from 20 to 80, almost the whole percentile, student growth percentile scale. Yet, like I say, the research on this has been clear, and 22 states are still use them. So one of the criticisms, tests are being made used for purposes beyond what they're made for, but also we as a testing profession aren't adhering to our own standards that say we need validity evidence to support each specific testing purpose. Okay, so lots of criticisms. Nobody's left yet. That's good. Let's talk about some solutions. So I mentioned these four things that I want to spend a little bit of time talking about today. The first is drawing on principles for assessment in the service of learning. I've been influenced by Edmund Gordon. I did not know Edmund Gordon. I had heard of the Gordon Commission. So in 2013, ETS funded the Gordon Commission on the Future of Assessment. So I knew of him when I was president of NCME. He sent me an email, Steve, I want to do this session at NCME. So I started to interact with him, and I knew Ed when he was a young man. This was 2019, and he was only 99 years old. Today is 104 and still going strong. Just amazing. He's like, Steve, 2 weeks ago you said this, and that connects with something Howard said yesterday. I'm like, oh my gosh. But his influence on me has been, we don't want to measure the outcome of learning. We want to use the process of measurement for learning. So let for learning be the driver. And to me as a psychometrician for most of my career, you know, really trying to get a really good snapshot of what students know, this was fascinating, to use tests not as the outcome of learning, but as a treatment. Can we use tests to help students learn? So that was really foreign for me. And he asked me to help him publish a handbook that would show people how to do assessment in the service of learning. And 4 years later, that dovetailed into a book series. So there's a handbook series on assessment in the service of learning. There's three volumes. They're all free. You can download them from UMass Libraries Press. There's probably 60 or 70 authors across these three volumes and addressing topics like game-based assessment, principles for assessment in the service of learning, rethinking the way we report scores, and so forth. If you don't have time to do the QR code, just Google Handbook for Assessment Service of Learning, Gordon or UMass or whatever, you'll find it. So the principles and assessment of a service of learning, Eva Baker and Howard Everson and Ed came up with these 9 principles for assessment of the service of learning. It's a lot of text for a PowerPoint slide, so I'm going to just summarize it. Clear and transparent purposes and uses. You have to be clear about what the tests are about. Explicit learning goals and progress indicators. Design that supports motivation, engagement, and metacognition. Modeling expectations and learning over time. Directly informing feedback and instructional decisions. Adaptability for diverse learners and evidence of quality and validity. If you look at these 9 principles and think about the criticisms we just went through, they're actually addressing those criticisms, right? So that's why I think if we take more steps towards assessment and service of learning, we're going to be able to address a lot of these criticisms. And I'll also mention that 3 of them are already in our standards. So if you look at the standards for educational and psychological testing, what's the first step? Saying what's the purpose of the test? Because the purpose of the test sets the goals for validation, for test development, and so forth. The standards talk about making the test accessible for all and that we have to have evidence in quality and validity. So these principles for assessment of the service of learning are simply adding some additional things onto 3 of our most important standards, and the add-ons are for supporting learning. Just some examples of using educational tests to support learning. I think the Duolingo language app that probably a lot of you have is a good example because it's trying to teach me Spanish for years by testing me. All it's doing is giving me test questions, right? So complete the sentence, translate the sentence, and so forth. So I'm actually learning by taking an assessment every day. And the other thing is through technology, through this type of digital assessment, it's easier to support motivation, engagement, and metacognition. So it's encouraging me as I'm plotting through my Spanish. And even if I look at the reports that it's giving me, these summary reports, it's not saying, Steve, you still can't understand when people talk to you in Spanish at a normal speed. It's not telling me what I can't do, it's telling me what I can do. So again, supporting my continued learning. We do have to contrast that with some of the reporting that we currently do. Former student Frances O'Donnell is now at the National Board of Medical Examiners. Her dissertation looked at all the different labels that we assign to students based on statewide summative testing. So she looked across all 50 states. We don't have the highest labels here, so like states that had 3 or 4 achievement levels, we left out the top. But if you look at the lowest levels, and here I'm pointing to standard not met is one label that was used in one state. Inadequate was a label that was used in another state. And beginning learner was a label that was used in another state. So if you think about it, what the students are coming home with on their score reports varies a lot. It might even be the same level of performance based on what state they're in. So mom, I'm a beginning learner. Mom, I'm inadequate. Can you imagine a state was using inadequate for 20 years? Anybody want to guess which state that was? I'll give you a hint, it's a state you can't say gay in, but you can say inadequate, Florida, that's right. Has been changed 2 years ago, but still. Just thinking about how we provide feedback to students, right? Okay, the next recommendation for addressing some of the criticisms is to leverage technology for more personalized assessment. So this is more forward-looking, right? We have to think outside of the tests we have currently. But the good news is we've got artificial intelligence to help us, and we have plenty of friends who can help us with this new leveraging of technology, and there's nothing to worry about there. They're all our friends. So what is personalized assessment? So I really like this article by Heather Buzik and her colleagues at ETS on personalized assessment. Another article from Educational Measurement Issues in Practice. Why do I keep pointing this out? Because guess who founded the journal Educational Measurement Issues in Practice? Frank Womer. I didn't know that until I was preparing for this talk. It's probably the most important journal in educational measurement because it has a very practice-friendly orientation. It's not all equations. Anyway, personalized assessment integrates personal characteristics in the assessment design and administration scoring procedures, interpretation, and use of scores. So it's really an evolution of adaptive testing, right? So we all know adaptive testing, Smarter Balance, GRE, GMAT, so forth, is adapting based on item difficulty. So if someone's doing really well, they get harder questions. If they're not doing very well, they get easier questions. But now we're adapting more on difficulty. We can adapt based on cultural interests, cultural groups, different work environments. And it's consistent with the idea of understandardization, which has to do with understanding who it is you're testing, the diversity within your population. So the idea is not what we've been doing for most of my career, which is let's try and develop the best test we can for most people. The idea in personalized assessment is let's create the best test we can for each individual learner. So everyone doesn't take the same test. Standardization is still there, but we just make what's standardized more flexible. And that increases validity because now we're trying to get the best estimate for each individual person. So we can personalize assessments, but subject to constraints, right? We still need to make sure we're fulfilling the testing purposes, which requires retaining validity and comparability. But comparability really depends on what the purpose is, the level of comparability you need. So we can do things like give people choice in what they read, choice in assessment context, how they want to take it. The idea of personalizing with respect to mirrors and windows, this is where I start to draw from Jennifer Randall's work. Mirrors meaning everyone sees themselves in the assessment rather than just dominant culture group. Windows into other cultures. Choice in language. Allow people, if they're multilingual, to use that as an asset rather than a deficit. And choice in scaffolds. If you want hints or calculator or repeat back, if you're listening to something on a listening assessment and so forth. And if you're concerned about the providing an advantage or whatever, that can be factored into scoring. So for example, it's really easy now. Translation has become super easy. So if you want to offer a test in different languages, that's something that's possible, assuming you're not measuring that language. If you want to just offer the directions in different languages, you can use that. But moving from choice in language to choice in item context, allowing choice in reading passages or writing prompts, different contexts depending on the subject area or the workplace. So for example, here's a standard from English Language Arts, right? From a reading test, determine the meaning of general, academic, domain-specific words, blah, blah, blah. It's a vocabulary standard. Do we need to give the same vocabulary word, the same passage to everybody to measure this standard? We don't across years, right? So we can give you choice. We'll give you choice in an article to read. Would you like to read about critical race theory, sports, food, something else? You chose sports. Would you like to read about UMass basketball, UMass women's basketball, psychometricians playing ping pong? And you're laughing, but this is actually a real thing. So just so you know. And I know it's silly to talk about UMass basketball when I'm in Michigan, where basketball's a real thing. Anyway, when I started UMass in 1996, right, more than 5 years ago, it was Calipari and Marcus Camby, and we went to the Final Four, and it was great, and then 28 years of mediocrity after that. Anyway, you chose UMass football. What does the word tough mean? You chose UMass women's basketball. What does word final mean? So different items measuring the same standard for different people. Now, I know some people say, well, what about comparability? Now they're different tests. They're not the same. And if you give students choice, they choose badly and so forth. I think it's important to remember, first of all, we can't pretend that we have comparability now, even when we have the same test form. This article is back from the 1940s talking about how if you change the order of the items in a test, the item difficulties change. If we have, test measuring different languages, like the United States is 23rd out of 65 countries on fourth grade math. Those countries all didn't take the same test because they don't all speak English. So there's different tests administered based on paper, computer, laptop, Mac, phone, and so forth. So we We think we have comparability, but there's always a degree of comparability. And if we think about just the reporting of results, think about reporting results across states, right? We've got different tests, different rules for adequate yearly progress, different content, different standards, different starting points. I know AYP has changed, but different student demographics. So we really don't have comparability at the levels we want to begin with. So I think the question has changed from should we personalize to how can we best personalize? And the answer is through constraints. We already have constraints when we build a test based on test specifications, right? So now we're talking about additional layers based on balancing the needs of comparability and validity. So the degree to which comparability is important depends on the testing purpose. If you want to see what individual student needs to do next, what their strengths and weaknesses are, comparability of those scores to another student might not be as important. If you have two people vying for the same job, competing for the same job, then comparability is going to be more important. So testing purpose has to be considered in test design. Testing systems that involve different tests designed for different purposes allow for what we call dirty assessments or design in real time assessments, where the interaction of the purpose of the test and the characteristics of the student determine what's generated for that student. And the idea of this design in real time assessment is by promoting fairness by reconceptualizing the idea of what needs to be the same for all. So I gave you two examples of those two different items, and choose your favorite metric or whatever metric you want to use in your test generation algorithm. But you could see the readability could be about the same, and you could dictate what the tolerance limits are around those. So if we have, this is an older slide because chat's what, 5 now. But if you give the chat or a generative AI a standard and then say, you know, generate a passage to measure it, you can get the, you know, readability limits on that and then say, okay, well, now give me a passage on a different topic and then also have constraints around what the readability tolerance limits are. So the idea here is that you can have more personalized assessments that are subject to the same level of comparability. Related to this is culturally responsive assessment principles, because personalization could involve culture. And if you look at the principles of culturally responsive assessment, and this is a new field, right? So I'm on my journey. I'm not the best person to talk about it. But these principles that came from Michael Walker and his colleagues at ETS talk about these five principles that are involved, right? So one is shared power. And the idea here is that the testing agency, the test developer, is not working in insular fashion. Here's the test, you guys take it. But rather building the test in community with the other stakeholders, with teachers, with students, with parents, anyone who has a stake or a right in the assessment to understand what they want and so that they feel part of the process. So we're fostering active participation, still having high expectations. And these expectations are that everybody can succeed. Flexibility, very similar to what I talked about for understandardization, and the idea that we'll report back in a very asset-based way. We've been doing a lot of work on culturally responsive assessment at UMass as part of our adult skills assessment program. And in looking at the literature, Omaya Horton, one of our students, came up with the way we're thinking about it is one, justice-oriented and participatory. So really similar to the engagement part of what Michael Walker and his colleagues were talking about. And it's really rooted in Geneva Gay's culturally responsive teaching. So if we borrow the principles from culturally responsive teaching and filter it through an assessment lens, we get culturally responsive assessment. We do have to acknowledge that testing has these historical harms that have led to contributions to systemic oppression that I mentioned before. And by the way, in a few years ago, the American Psychological Association issued an apology to people of color because of the roles that tests have played in systemic oppression. It critically engages communities. Culturally responsive assessment leverages test takers' cultural experiences to enhance their learning, emphasizes the anti-racist validity. And what we mean by that is the idea that A simple differential predictive validity study is not going to be able to justify test use on its own. Acknowledges that all assessments are fallible, and fosters the recognition of all test takers' capacity for high achievement, and provides validating, empowering, and healing results. So hopefully you can see how culturally responsive assessment is very consistent with assessment in the service of learning. And again, Jennifer Randall is someone we draw a lot from. What does culturally responsive assessment look like? Let me show you a couple examples of what we've been doing on UMass, but remember, this is a work in process. And what we've been experimenting with, we've got some operational testing programs that we can't mess with too much because, you know, people are taking them. But we have this IES-funded Department of Education grant to build assessments in reading and maths for adults that would be more formative. And also trying to bridge to the workplace. So our theory of action for the adult skills assessment program is that we're trying to provide valuable information from assessments to empower adults to improve their academic and occupational goals. So the learner interacts with our assessment system that provides information on their literacy and numeracy that informs them, their counselor, their employer, their teacher, that triggers further action. So our approach for culturally responsive assessment on the ASAP is, first of all, co-design. So that whole idea of engaging with the communities and to understand how can we let students see themselves in the assessment and how can we use these results from our engagement with the field in design. All right, so this is just an example of all the writings from Jennifer Randall that have influenced our work. The purpose of our co-design studies is to understand the diversity of the needs of the people we're testing. So what we did, and this is, this might not sound foreign to you if you're not from the psychometric field, but for psychometricians to walk away from their computer and go to talk to people who are taking the test, that's big, right? And, in my more than 5 years, I've only done this a few times, but we learned so much. Right, so you see we went to people on the job in employment settings, in adult education settings, ESL programs, and so forth. And we summarized some of what we've learned. And like we thought they wouldn't like multiple choice items. Ends up the adults do because they're familiar. But they don't like items that don't have real world contexts. They want to see their items after they take the test, what they got right and what they got wrong. They don't like the mysterious scaling stuff that we all love. They want choice in what to read. Something interesting. Give me something interesting. No capciosas. That's a word I learned as a Spanish learner. I didn't know this word. But there was this one woman who's like, yeah, these test questions are capciosas. I don't know if people know this, but the rough translation is trick questions, right? So they see this as the tests are trying to trick me. They're not trying to help me. Trying to allow tests to be shorter. No time limits and so forth. Based on some of our co-design work, what we did is we created these avatars. Now, not avatars for people when they take the test, but avatars that are influencing our test development workflow. So our workflow is now very AI assisted. And these avatars are based on real students or based on a composite of students in a class or working with teachers about who their students are. So now we're letting the AI engine know, like if you say to AI, make this item culturally relevant, or make this item relevant to Hispanic Latinos, you're gonna get Maria ate a taco for lunch and paid this much money. It's gonna be very stereotypical, not very culturally enriching. But with these avatars that are rich descriptions about the students, it helps generate test content that's more culturally relevant. So the way this design and real-time assessment works, and we haven't fully accomplished this vision yet, but let me show you the vision. Once you have a testing purpose, so for example, a certification purpose can read and understand safety guides and users' manuals, we've got our items and our sets of items in our item banking system, right? That's linked to our item test delivery system. So given the input of a testing purpose, which we always have, that determines the test specification. So for this purpose, we do need some security. We need a certain level of reliability, which determines a certain number of items. And then we input the personalization options. So this is in food confectionery, food preparation business, confectionery in Arkansas. The warehouse gets pinged to pull out the most relevant assessment tasks that produce the assessment for that person. So what we've been doing in our interactions with the human-directed AI in the loop is to, you know, put in what we typically put in, right? We want to measure the standard at this level, but now we've got the other characteristics, whether it's a workplace or a culture or whatever, that helps develop the prompts, helps develop the items. There's a recent article that's published that I think has some really good information for those of you who want to use more AI in test development. It came out like last week, maybe the week before. This journal, Psychothema, is out of Spain, but the article's in English and it's freely available, open source. All right, thanks for bearing with me so far. The last suggestion for addressing the criticisms of tests is to investigate testing consequences. This shouldn't seem like a surprise, because since 1999, the Standards for Educational and Psychological Testing have had five sources of validity evidence, and the fifth one is consequences of testing. So validity evidence based on testing consequences is not anything new, although people do argue, you know, should we look at testing consequences? For me, it's the most important thing to investigate, because tests are supposed to have intended consequences, right? They're developed for specific purposes. So seeing whether the tests are fulfilling those purposes is validity 101. Susan Lyons in Educational Measurement Issues and Practice wrote, "The consequence of test use should bear directly on decisions about the appropriateness and continuation of the testing program." So when people are criticizing tests, we need that validity evidence to show why we're justified in continuing to administer these tests. Going back even before the 1999 standards, Messick, who's probably the most famous validity theorist of all time, might just edge out Kronbach, talked about how important it is to consider consequences in validation, even to the point where we have to weigh the potential social consequences of using the test against the consequences of not using the test at all. Try and have that conversation with some policymakers. But what do the standards say about consequences of testing? A fundamental purpose of validation is to indicate whether the specific benefits are likely to be realized. So this idea of studying testing consequences is not just looking at the bad, right? There should be positive consequences of tests, providing valuable information on student learning. If you're in a licensure context, protecting the public, certifying competence, assistant selection, and so forth. And then some of the negative consequences too. So these criticisms that we talked about at the beginning become hypotheses to investigate, right? So as we embrace the criticisms, now we have some validity studies to follow up on. I have not been doing a good job of keeping track of my time. I don't know if I'm fast or slow, but let me start to summarize. First of all, educational testing is hard. I don't need to tell you that. You all have hard jobs, right? Because we need to measure large bodies of knowledge and skill, and we're trying to provide useful, actionable information without taking up too much time, without interrupting education being part of the educational process in a way that accommodates and supports a wide variety of student needs. So I know what I'm talking about today is a big deal, right? Because we've already have a hard job developing one test, and now we want to personalize it and do all these other things. But if we do it, and we can do it because of technology, we're not only going to get better measurement, we're going to place measurement in a better position to inform learning. So have we addressed these criticisms? I think the hardest part of a workout, at least for me, is getting to the gym. If I get to the gym, I'm going to have a workout. Why am I saying that? Because I think perhaps the hardest part in addressing testing criticisms is to first realize that they're there, right? To acknowledge them. If we're going to improve what we're doing, we have to acknowledge that there are some problems. It's okay to have problems. We can't be perfect. One of the reasons I went into psychometrics is because I like problem solving, and trying to measure something about somebody you can't see, that's a pretty hard problem to solve. So I believe the shift to use tests to help students learn will recenter educational assessment where it belongs, in the service of learning, and that will help us regain public trust. I also believe that personalized and culturally responsive assessment will improve validity. And if I was effective even a little bit today, you'll agree with that or at least see that. So have we addressed the criticisms through these four ways? Drawing on principles for assessment service of learning, leveraging technology, culturally responsive assessment, and focusing on testing consequences. I think this gives us some possibilities that make the current state of affairs in educational testing very exciting. Yes, we have to get through what we're doing right now, but if we think, how can we improve things? How can we deal with our vendors to do better, right? Because a lot of the vendors have their systems. They don't want to change, but we see the possibilities of change. And a lot of the vendors are following up on these possibilities too, which is exciting. So the idea of leveraging technology to engage students, provide better testing experiences, and provide useful information. So the one of the themes of the criticism is like, there's no value here. If we can make students engaging with the test the way they engage with video games, we'll have really done something. So if we can do these things, maybe people will change their opinions. Instead of saying, don't get testy with me, they'll say, get testy with me. So that's how I tied it back to the title. I'd just like to say I'm representing a team of faculty, graduate students, and researchers at University of Massachusetts. We're happy to engage with you and share more of what we're doing and partner with you. So let's continue the conversation. And if you do want to take the survey, there's the URL. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Let's give another round of applause. Great conversation. I think Frank Wilmer would be proud. And he's looking down on us and thinking, wow, wow. Just a couple quick announcements before we vacate the room so that we can close the door. Today you should have either a white or blue badge showing. Hopefully you're still giving each other the blue dots from yesterday when something is impacting you. Please turn off all your excess devices so that we can make sure that the internet and connectivity is strong, especially for the presenters. Gluten-free lunch today. There is no dairy or gluten in the lunch, so everybody should be fine with that. If you have any questions, you can see Sue out in the hallway. And that's it. We will see you for our D sessions here in just about 12, 13 minutes. Thank you.